Welcome back to Dr. Rock's radio show here on MSIRadio.com and ScotlandIsFree.ning.com. And we move from talking about earthly matters and leis and the energy, the local energies to us now, hopefully to a chat with Santos Bonacci about astrotheology and astronomy and what you call syncretism. Thank you very much for joining me, Santos.
Yeah, thanks, brother. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to meet you.
Yeah. It is. Likewise, yeah.
So you've got a couple of sessions here, and I know you've got an awful lot of stuff that you could pack into there. What are you planning on? How are you going to explore these three words that you've given us on the program?
Well, here at Stonehenge, I'm going to do the sun. Everything that has ever been of importance that has ever been said about the sun, from every perspective, really. The ancients revered the sun and its beautiful white pure light, and today we acknowledge also the sun's virtues. So we're going to go all through history and see what people have ever thought of the sun. We're going to look at the cross that the sun produces as it goes through the tropical points on the ecliptic, which is really just the symbol of the sine wave. That's what the cross is.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Russell said, the secret of creation is in the wave. That's the wave. So when you look at the cross, that is the key, the cipher. So it's telling you, study the wave. It's a wave universe, a thought wave universe. And so that's the presentation here for Stonehenge. I've done 8 in 20 days since I've been here. The first one was St. Anne's, and there we did the science behind the science. So we explained the magnetic causal universe in which we live, which produces the electric universe of effects.
Yeah, so one of them is inspiration and the other one's movement, effectively.
Yep.
Yeah, and science is really catching up with that now, isn't it? It's leaping forward a huge amount. But I was watching a vid recently called Primer Fields, where a man has made himself a couple of monopolar magnets and is effectively demonstrating that they are the kind of, if you like, the mould for absolutely everything, from kind of individual suns up to nebulae, which is, the modern end of the story that you're telling, I guess. What did we think about, what are our earliest references to the sun? What did we originally believe about the sun?
Good one. Yeah, good question. And just before I answer that, I actually used that documentary Primer Fields by David LaPointe in that presentation to explain the science of light, because he did a wonderful job with that. He really did a great job, because he did that from the perspective of the effects in a laboratory, to back engineer to the cause.
Yeah.
So it's just wonderful 3-part documentary. I recommend for everybody to see it.
Me too. Me too. I haven't had a chance to go into it in detail yet, but it is fantastic.
Yep. In particular, the part 3 where it talks about Saturn and the reason why we can see his rings. Its rings, I guess, because its north, its rotational axis and its east-west axis are perfectly in alignment, perfectly perpendicular, you see, whereas Jupiter's is not. Neither are any of the other planets.
They do have rings around them, a lot of them, don't they?
They do. They all have rings. We can't see them because they're not in alignment. You see, and David LaPointe explains this in part 3. It's beautiful. When you see that, you go, aha.
Yeah.
Then you realise what's going on. You see, if the other planets are not in alignment, it's for a reason. It's got to be.
Yeah.
You know, the solar system is a thinking organism. It's a creature. It thinks and corrects, anything that needs correcting. And so it's there for a reason. Saturn is a malefic. So that is a bad energy, a destructive energy in our solar system, and yet it is perfectly aligned.
Mm-hmm.
So it does your head in when you think about this. So you think, hang on, well, Jupiter's the greater benefic, and he is the benefactor, the great generous planet.
Yeah.
And people born under his signs like Sagittarius and Pisces are usually jovial. Jupiter, jovial.
Yeah.
And whereas his axis is, then it's not aligned. So nature you know, it, obviously sometimes she benefits us when she's not in alignment. It's chaos out of order, order out of chaos, you
yeah.
see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's something to think about. It really does your head in, but then you begin to understand how, you know, the solar system works and nature. It goes into balance and it goes out of balance. It's a play.
Yeah. And it's also moving from one state of balance to a new state of balance.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful sexual dance.
Yeah.
The two sexes of electricity, negative and positive.
Another thing I saw that I really enjoyed, I'm going to use it in one of my talks, in fact, was a video called the little animation called The Earth Does Not Revolve Around the Sun. And it shows the long body of the sun in action,
yeah.
With the sun steaming through. They assume a straight line on it because I think that the animation would be a bit difficult with the little loops that it kicks all the time. But they have the planets literally swarming around it.
Yeah.
You see Pluto forming this really fantastic long arc round and up. And it's so much, so far from the static image that I had of like a disk of planets basically flying through space.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that would be the model of Dr. Keshava Bhatt. He was an Indian who went to Argentina. I think he died a couple of years ago, and he explained the vortex solar system, and he made that video. But I also have a few of my good friends on the School of the Holy Science, which we are involved in, Matt Presti, Robert Otay, and Jason Verbelli in particular, who do a lot of Russellian natural science, and they talk about the vortex solar system too. Then you've got people like Nassim Harriman. You've got the book, The Awaspi of the 19th century, late 19th century, talking about the vortex solar system. So they knew that it was a winged serpent. They knew that it was Viracocha flying, all motion is spiral. So yeah. This solar body is just spiraling through the...
And it is like a vortex.
Yeah.
It is just like a vortex. So what about this sun then, these early ideas of the sun? How did we express these when we first started writing, or however it was that we communicated our ideas? What did early man think about the sun? Was the sun the sun, or is this rumour that Saturn was our first sun correct? Two questions in one now.
Yeah, that's a biggie, that one.
Yeah.
Well, Saturn is the big daddy, right? So Jupiter was born from Saturn,
yeah.
And then Jupiter has his progeny, of course. So, yeah, Saturn is a father, you know, he's old man Cronos, and Walter Russell explains that planets come from rings, equators of suns, moons come from equators of earths.
Okay.
And then they return as they grow into suns, and then back into planets, and then back to suns. And they do this because they rotate and orbit. And the rotation is always increasing in speed. And the orbit, or let's call it, because we know it's not an orbit really, right? It's a trajectory, right?
Yeah.
Spiral trajectory. But when one cycle is completed, well, let's call it an orbit. for simplicity.
We know what we're talking about.
That orbit is always expanding and slowing. So the Earth, for instance, as Walter Russell teaches, is spinning faster all the time to maintain its centripetal force, and the orbit is receding and going further away from the sun all the time and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So the Earth will be where Mars is one day and take 600 days to do an orbit.
And this happens presumably over fairly rapid time, because it seems to me that in written history the planets were believed to have been much closer to us than they are now.
Mm. Yes. Yep. They were much closer to the sun. And they don't fly off on a tangent because of this spinning faster and orbiting slower. So they maintain a balance with centripetal and centrifugal forces.
Yeah.
This is how the vortex solar system works. And then these go off and become suns. You know, the earth will be a sun, and then it will return to being Gaia again, you know. And this goes on in perpetuity, according to Walter Russell, until the universe, the causal universe, decides it's had enough play and Brahma withdraws his breath of 15 billion years.
As has happened many times before, we're told.
Mm.
In some senses, all of this is happening in the blink of an eye.
Mm. So Saturn would be, you know, look, it's always a story of Horus and Set. Horus is the sun, Set is Saturn. And they're always, you know, vying for control of the order of the solar system. Saturn rules the dark, the sun rules the day. So Horus takes over during the day, Set takes over at sunset in the scales of Libra, because Set is the exultant planet of Libra in astrology. And whereas Aries, the exultant planet of the sun, is always on the eastern horizon, when the sun rises, as Aries arises. And that's how the heavens are structured, you see. So possibly, in line with Russellian science, Saturn probably is considered to be a central sun in that aspect, that it is the dark sun. So there are two suns,
okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps, I mean, that could be one way of explaining it. Another way would probably be to harmonise with what they say at Thunderbolts, if you're aware of the Electric Universe guys, Don Talbot and all those guys.
Yeah.
I think they're doing a great job.
Me too.
Yeah, personally, I think they should consider the Magnetic Universe of Russell, though, and that will help them to understand that...
Well, I figure that the electricity and the magnetism arise at the same time. So if your primer fields is correct, then you can expect a lot of electricity as a result.
Mm.
So they're not sort of separate things, are they?
The didgeridoo fell. They're doing a great job nonetheless, because they respect the mythologies, and writers such as Manuel Velikovsky, which I cut my teeth on in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Even though I was a Jehovah's Witness, you know, I was reading that stuff because one of the sisters says...
How did that work? Because I often think, having read the Velikovsky, I'm thinking, what would happen if the people who are adhering to the texts, the standard religious texts, in whatever form they're taking them, what would happen if everybody did read that book?
Well, I'll tell you what will happen. I'll answer that in a tick when I finish with the Saturn thing, and that is that they put Saturn in a coaxial... orbit or arrangement with our Earth at the bottom, Saturn at the top, and in between the two would be Venus and Mars, and which would explain all these ancient prehistoric glyphs and depictions of the sun and the old sun looking so strange to us and foreign, but because we are not any longer in this coaxial. And so Saturn, you know, emanated a different kind of light and therefore was considered to be the first sun. So we have to think about that. I would give that some serious thought.
Mm.
But what happens when you read Emmanuel Velikovsky in 1983, because a sister in the congregation who was very wise, and it's probably passed on by now, but she said to me, because she saw that I was a very, very keen student of history, and she said, Brother Bernacchi, you need to... read two writers, Rene Norbergen's Secret of the Lost Races.
Yes. What a book, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you need to read Emmanuel Velikovsky. And I did. So you imagine for a couple of decades knocking on people's doors, knowing all along that this great Jewish Russian scientist, friend of Einstein, but much derided in the academic world because they don't like these, left... side thinkers, you know what I mean? They want everything to be according to what the universities are dishing out, you know? So he was criticized a lot, but he spoke about Venus, and Venus in Latin, venere, shares the same root of the verb to come.
Yeah.
So she's just recently come into this solar system. He reckons it's about 3,500 years ago. and that would affect the solar system and may cause a lot of changes, possibly explains the Moses myth and the parting of the Red Sea with the island of the Minoan culture sinking in the Mediterranean, etc. He linked up all those things, and I thought that was exquisite. So I read all of his books, Ages in Chaos, Worlds in Collision, and even Oedipus being Akhenaten. So reading Norbergen and this and other works like Alexander Hislop's The Two Babylons, explaining the mythologies and all of that, well, what happens when you do that, brother, is you turn out to be a syncretist, as I am. because that's what happens.
Yeah.
And this is why Jehovah's Witnesses are not encouraged to read Emanuel Velikovsky and Ring Norbergen and all of these guys.
Yeah. So what do you mean by a syncretist?
Well, you begin to see that it's all one. It's one soup. Theology is alchemy, is astronomy, is astrotheology, is astrology.
Yeah.
And they are all different languages expressing the science of light and existence and who we are. We are light. God is light. I am the light of the world, says Jesus, the literary hero that we all love and adore. It's not a literal hero, but that we've been instructed, you know, in our churches and in our left-brained institutions that it was a historical thing, you see. And, well, this is okay for children because this is a teaching tool. But there are seven other layers in all of the sacred texts that we are ignoring.
Yeah.
Astrology's there.
Yeah.
The Bible's full of pure astrology.
Isn't it funny how we don't know it's there, but once you know that it is, like once I'd read Velikovsky and these ideas of Venus and Mars having physical noticeable effects on planet Earth in times when people were writing it down, then suddenly loads of things that were mysterious in the Bible become unmysterious.
Yeah.
Lots of the things that happen in the prophets, the Exodus, all of that. And then again in these other books as well, the Popol Vuh, the Mayan books, lots and lots of the mysterious stuff that seems to be just really cryptic given the way we're taught suddenly becomes clear. It's like it's been hidden in plain sight.
Absolutely. And you know what it does? It brings you in the middle, in unity consciousness, and you're not doing what they're doing out there. You've got extremists who will kill you for these sacred texts, and then you've got right at the other pole, people like Richard Dawkins, for instance, who is, you know, down on God and these scriptures because he was a blasphemous, evil, vindictive God who sanctioned only one race, the Jews, and to go forth into the land of Canaan and slay the Canaanites and the Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Ammonites, etc., and to cut open the pregnant women and dash their children on the crags. Well, so you've got Richard Dawkins on the left over here and you've got extremists on the right with the Bible in one hand and the sword in another, and they're going to kill you because the texts are so true and literal. And we don't need either of these. This is buffoonery because, for a start, they are literary. It's a gospel. It's mythology. It's a song.
Yeah.
It's Homeric poetry. Can't we see this? You know, slaying children is in reference to immature thoughts, which only the lower-minded goy in the outer courtyard are able to manifest. Immature thoughts. So they go and indulge, like Pinocchio, in all of these deceits and distractions, go to the theatres and the shows and commerce, and there's money to be made and there's religions to go and follow and priests on every corner and salesmen, you see. Syncretism teaches you that look a bit deeper with these scriptures. There's no vindictive God telling anyone to kill. It's the spirit teaching us to kill anything which is going to be harmful to our evolution. So the land of Canaan is the three chakras below the heart chakra. The bottom one's called Soma, The next one's called Gomorrah. You see?
Yeah.
Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
And we are to destroy the energy, or, well, put that the energy of the lower chakras in balance, you know. So we need to send fire and sulfur down to Sodom and quench its thirst for lust.
Yeah.
You know, and then moderate our habits, and then we enter the heart chakra. As we are, because right now we're in the age of Leo, opposite Aquarius.
Opposite Aquarius.
Yeah. See, we to keep things simple, we just reference the one, vernal equinox, Aquarius. Oh, we're in the age of Aquarius. But opposite Aquarius, the man, is the lion, you see?
Yeah.
And the lion is ruled by the sun, Jesus. And Aquarius, the man, is ruled by Saturn, Set. That's Horus, the sun, and Set.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
So
that we should be choosing to put the emphasis at this point on Aquarius.
Yeah. So when those two line up, as the Sphinx suggests, the body of Horus and the head of Set,
mm-hmm.
you see, Seti was an Egyptian king, and he was the father of Ramses the Great, Seti at first. He was a great king, you see, and is in reference to Set, Saturn. And so when this lines up, and we are now in the reign of the Messiah, the Jews who are looking, the Messiah's come. Jesus has returned, and that is Leo.
Yeah.
Because Leo has the star Regulus in it,
yeah.
and it's on the ecliptic, it's the heart chakra, and the Arabs in their astrology tell you that that star is called the Messiah. He is now there on the autumnal equinox for 2,000 years. And Aquarius, ruled by Saturn, and his daddy Uranus, Uranus means heavens, it's the kingdom of heaven. We've got Jesus on one side in Leo, we've got Set on the other side, Horus and Set, and we've got the Father, Uranus, in heaven, in Aquarius, pouring down spiritual waters on us. That's what Aquarius is all about. And when this alignment happens, humanity will be in the heart chakra. So we should be done with capitalism, materialism, commerce, and all those things dealing with survival in the lower chakras. It's over. Materialism has had its day. And
can't we see people's minds changing? You know, yeah. As I heard a man saying the other day, he was an astrologer, in fact, and he was saying, you know, they are changing. He's saying it's really only 10, 15, 20 years ago that bankers were regarded as, you know, people who you could rely on to give you good information. He was saying if you were, you know, if you were in the light entertainment industry in the 70s or 80s, then you are now being looked at somewhat differently. And it is because we are no longer turning our eyes away from these things.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's an awakening.
Yeah.
It's a conscious awakening. It's the return of the Christ. The Messiah is here, and the Messiah is we, the people.
Yeah.
There's no vicarious redeemer, you know. This is a concoction. It's a construct. It's a fictional, subjective construct of the churches to keep people in search of the one coming. You know, he's always coming. That's what Jesus means. It's an Egyptian word, you, the one coming,
mm-hmm.
who is in the you wheel, which is the Yule wheel, which is the year, the ecliptic. And he's always coming. There are seven heroes on the ecliptic. Starting with Aries, there's Perseus, the first deacon, standing there slaying Medusa, the starlit knight. So when the sun arises in Aries every morning, there he is, Perseus, or Prometheus with the morning fire, Prince Charming. And then there is Orion in Taurus immediately after, and next to him is Auriga. And these are the heroes that are always coming. Then there's Bootes in Virgo. He's coming. He's the shepherd. He has a sickle in his hand. It's the harvest month right now, September.
Yeah.
Virgo's tomorrow. It's the 21st of August, right? And it'll be the harvest moon. And Virgo, she holds a sheaf of wheat, because when the sun passes, transits her sign, she gives us wheat. Look around. You see, the hay is being harvested today.
Yeah. Wheat's still out there, but...
Yeah. Yeah, and then there is in Scorpio, there is Ophiuchus and Hercules. And then lastly, the seventh hero is in Pisces, the feet. and that is Cephas, who's got his foot on Polaris, the North Pole. And these guys are always coming. These are the Jesus on the Yule wheel, Christos, the Christ, you know, because when the sun goes from solstice to solstice, he makes a cross on the earth.
Yeah.
All you've got to do is put a sundial in your backyard and you'll see the crisscross every year.
Yeah.
And that's Christos, Christ, crystal.
Yeah.
You know, the crystal universe we live in, light.
Yeah.
Light is crisscrossing. Those interference waves are causing things to appear before our eyes. But they are illusions.
Yeah.
Energy. And so, and this is the religion of Christianity. It is the true religion slash science of the universe. The first fathers, so-called fathers of the Catholic Church, admitted this, i.e. Augustine and Eusebius, and they said that Christianity is not new. There never was a time in history of the universe that there was not Christianity. It's the science of light. Christ is light. It's consciousness. God is light.
We can sort of see that going on, can't we? Because the names of the planets came, you know, via the Romans from the Greeks who translated them from the Babylonians, who translated them from the Sumerians. You can see the sort of, you can see the continuity of the story. It just seems to be being slightly differently crafted as each different age looks at it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look at, let's compare the Mediterranean 2,000 years ago, when syncretism was alive and well in the Ptolemaic period, especially in Alexandria, which churned out many great teachers, Clement of Alexandria, Origen. We have, Plutarch was the oracle of Delphi, Saint Delphi, he was in Greece. But we have, I think, Plotinus went down to Alexandria. All the great theologians and astrotheologians of history. And there was the Greek system and the Jewish system. Take your pick. In the Greek Christian, you see, we have the New Testament is the Christian Greek scriptures. Please, all the listeners... Please pay attention to that. It's Greek, because the other teaching is Hebrew. It's Jewish. And that's there was two schools, two major blocks of schools in Alexandria.
Yeah.
The big Sanhedrin, the 70, you know, the Septuagint was translated there and everything into Greek from Hebrew. There's always been this Greek-Jewish thing, right?
Yeah.
Right. So, the Jews tell you that Jesus... the Christian system, the Christian Greek system tells you that Jupiter Zeus, is the son of Joseph and Mary. In the Greek system, they tell you that Zeus is the son of Kronos and Rhea. Well, Kronos is Saturn, is Set, is Seth, is Seth. Joseph, from Seth, Saturn.
Yeah.
So Jesus, yes?
Yes.
He's the son of Saturn. And his consort, Rhea, is Maria. So, take a peek. That's one story.
Yeah.
It's the story of the ecliptic. And whether it's Kronos and Rhea who have Zeus, or whether it's Joseph, from Set, from Saturn, and Maria, who have Jesus, it's the same story.
Yeah.
And everywhere you go, it's that story. How old man time has one son who is able to defeat that principle of time. He who is born in time perishes in time. And that's why Saturn is the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
The thin, emaciated, black old man.
The devourer of children.
Yeah, exactly. But one escapes. Manly P. Hall beautifully explains this when he's in his astrotheological audio files. He explains that this is the principle of Jupiter defeating his father and therefore becoming the king and the beneficiary to mankind. He's the benefactor. In astrology, he is the greater benefic. In astrology, Saturn is the greater malefic. There will always be a war between Jesus and Satan. Jesus and Satan, or Horus and Set.
Yeah.
Because in another archetype, Jupiter becomes the sun. Yeah, Horus. They are always interchangeable. You see, the archetypes are always interchangeable.
What do you think of the Thunderbolt project, or David Talbot's point that all of the archetypes were born in these distant times, and that none have been born of modern experience? Do you think that's a fair comment?
Ooh, depends on what context he's talking about. There's nothing new under the sun. See, syncretism, I've never said anything new. I'm not smart enough, you know. I'm just telling forth what I can point to that I know and can verify and that can be verified. And so it's old. How old? Perennially old. It's the perennial philosophy. So, yes, he's right to an extent. He's spot on. Yeah. There's nothing new under the sun. Syncretism has always been. It always will be. So no one invents it. Just a small example. We have astrologers incorrectly teaching that the Greeks added Libra 2,000 years ago because there were only 10 signs, and then they squeezed in Libra and, you know, redacted the system and modified it. And, you know. But the Dendra stone has Libra in it, right where it should be, on the September equinox, exactly where it is on the ecliptic, as it has been perennially. And the Dendra stone, the quackademics will tell you that it's at least 5,000 years old, but you go down to the Kemet school of ancient mysticism in Egypt, the true indigenous wisdom keepers of the true Egyptian history, tell you that it's probably add a zero to anything that the quackademics tell you. So, and Abdel Hakim Awyan, who features a lot in Carmen Bulter's Pyramid Code, great documentary, better than all the other rubbish that, you know, there's a lot of rubbish about Egypt put out there, but Carmen Bulter's one of them, that's really good. And also who's the American guy, I interviewed him, he goes down to Egypt a lot, and I'll get his name in a minute. He does tours every year.
Hancock?
Graham Hancock. We'll think of him in a minute. He's from New York, and I interviewed him on American Freedom Radio, and he's also got a wonderful documentary. I just want to highlight those two.
Yeah.
We'll get his name in a minute. But Abdel Hakim Awyan, I'll be speaking there actually in November this year.
Yeah.
If things quieten down, it was supposed to be last year and we cancelled it. But that's what they teach. Add an extra zero to it. So Libra's been there for at least 50,000 years. Mm-hmm. And then I would add another couple of zeros, perhaps another 40 or 50 zeros. After that, because it's perennial, you know.
Isn't it funny how we kind of, I mean, it strikes me as a bit odd when you can see that it's there so far back that we have managed to get this idea that the Greeks added it in fairly recent past. It seems to me to be strange how these ideas are forgotten about or lost or hidden or whatever. But my guess is that if we're coming into a point where we're effectively saying that we're recognising the unity of everything, whereas up until recently we appear to have been emphasising difference, then it's going to be less easy to hide these things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this is going on in everything. Musicians do it when they have a jam and they cross genres, you know. I've done it plenty of times. I'm a musician, you know, and I've actually been a syncretic musician without really even knowing it, because I play a fusion of flamenco, Latin, and jazz, and I've done that all my life.
Wild.
You know. Yeah, so it's already happening. You know, that's what a fusion is. You fuse things together. So you could call syncretism fusion. You could call it unity thinking.
And we are seeing it all manner of ways, because I've been thinking recently about how different our diets are over here from what they used to be when I was born in the 60s, when we really did have our own national cuisine, which is nothing like as distinguished as it is now. But now we see a fusion of all manner of different sorts of cooking and foods from all over the world. And
exactly. When I was growing up in Australia as a second generation Italo-Australian, I suppose, my parents just recently immigrated from southern Italy. And, you know, so they were still putting olives and spinach bread, you know, whole grain bread sandwiches in my lunchbox. And back then, you know, I would see people giggling and saying, oh, look at this little Italian boy's, you know, eating, you know, all these. And now it's that in Australia, you've got every cafe is the, if it's rare if there's not olives and panini and bruschetta and focaccia, you know, and espresso, ristretto, cappuccino, you know, and it's, and here I've come to England for the first time in my life and it's here everywhere, focaccias everywhere, and it's all cosmopolitan. In fact, I'm, to be honest, I'm eating better here in England than I did in Italy.
I think the food here is really good now. Yeah. There's so much decent stuff around. Yeah. Long may it continue. That's all I can say, because most of it comes from an awfully long way away. You know, it's difficult for us to grow here. A lot of the things that make food particularly flavoursome, it'd still be hard for us to do the pepper and the spices, and even, you know, with polytunnels and modern technology and all of that. So where do you see us going?
Well,
these are pretty febrile times, aren't they?
Yeah, I see this exponential curve of conscious awakening in the kingdom of heaven, which we are in now, Aquarius Leo axis. Kingdom of heaven is nothing other than the kingdom of head. Head is heaven. The ascension that we are experiencing is in our biochemical laboratory, which is the Temple of Solomon, our bodies, architect of which was Hiram. The Hiram is Aries, the cerebran, the high Aries in heaven, in head, in the cranium.
Yeah.
And below that you have the cerebellum, Taurus, the Taurian brain. And so we are now accessing those higher chakras. The bull is the pituitary gland, and the ram is the pineal gland. Yeah, and these two are being activated. And so we are in heaven. We are in head, heaved up. And so this curve will grow exponentially, and we won't know ourselves in the next, you know, from week to week, from month to month, it's just going to grow. And I think everybody will benefit. Even these types who are so engrossed in commerce and in the illusion, like politicians and, you know, and industrial magnates and powerful men and women, you know, I think they're just going to just lose all that shit.
I think,
and
so,
grow up.
So many of them have just come accidentally to stand in the shadow. They can just as accidentally stand back into the light again. But it does seem to me that it's getting harder and harder to ignore the harm, loss and damage that's being done by the activities of some to others in the world, to the planet itself, and to and thus, as David Bohm says, thus to the what does he call it, to the implicate order out of which everything springs, that our activities have until lately been kind of corrupting the place from which everything springs. And it does seem to me that everybody in their own way that I'm meeting is coming to realize that that's what we've been doing. Once you know that's what you're doing, you can't carry on, can you? And it is, it seems to me to be an explosive movement at the moment. It's gathering, people's awakening is gathering pace so fast.
People are really starting to feel that there's a oneness, more of a oneness with everyone. So this is something that is happening. It's creeping up on them. Even the the people who are caught up in the whole thing, you know, it's creeping up on them too. And you can see changes in them that perhaps, you know, we did on our journey, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, you know, and they're following along, and it seems that, they will follow, and we are following the footsteps of other greater ones in front of us. You know, when I went to Salisbury Cathedral today, we realized I was with Maria Wheatley and what's her colleague that wrote the book together on Avebury and all of that. She's quite a learned person. So today I went to Avebury, Stonehenge, Salisbury Cathedral. But we realised...
Salisbury Cathedral is pretty impressive,
isn't it? Oh, yeah. And when we stood and looked at the facade and we saw all of those saints and great heroes of the past, because whether they were... Well, they're imperfect heroes, you know, they're not... Yeah, but they were heroes nonetheless. These were people that blazed the path, you know, the spiritual path, and illumined it and tried to help us. Maybe not all of them, you know. I mean, you've got to remember, it's a cathedral, so you know, still part of the fictional
establishment
and stuff like that. But certainly, you know, we got to give these people the benefit of the doubt, and they tried to be visionary and, you know, make the path brighter for us. So, and you would have to be really devoted to your science and your art to build a cathedral like that. It is splendid. It is an orchestra of sound and light. That's what it is. And even though it's bending now and the spire, the tallest in England, is leaning a couple of degrees, they've rectified that with, you know, flying buttresses and what have you. I saw that today.
Yeah.
And I actually saw the pillars inside the cathedral leaning. There is a serious lean. It's like the Leaning Tower of Pisa I saw a month ago in Pisa. And
is it built on solid ground, Salisbury? I can't remember, because I know that Winchester Cathedral is built on kind of faggots. It's built in a bog. It actually floats. The damn thing floats, broadly speaking.
Yep. I would say that Salisbury is pretty much soft, like the first cathedral that they built. There was one that they built, and 5 days later it was hit by a lightning bolt and fell to the ground.
Yeah, I remember the story.
And there was another one they built, and it fell into the swamp, you see. It was too soft. Right, so this one is also suffering, right? Yeah. So it's got this bend, you can see it, and it's quite scary, actually. But when you look at the workmanship, the masons, the stone masons in there, they were so devoted, you know.
Yeah.
So we come from, we are creators, you know, we're cosmocrators too. We are co-creators. We create cathedrals.
Yeah. What did you think about the other ancient sites? It must be great to come to the UK and catch. What did you think, make of Stonehenge, actually seeing it in the flesh?
Great. Well, I had Maria and, you know, Wheatley, and she just gave me the best tour. Then we went to West Kennet, and we went into there, and there was a group film, a documentary crew in there. We had to wait 20 minutes. They are filming crop circles, and we went in there with Gary, who's going to be speaking here tomorrow, Stonehenge.
Gary Evans,
yeah. And he brought his Turkish drum. Mm-hmm. And we did some drum work, some sound work in those chambers. We went into each five of those chambers, each one, and tested the acoustics in there and played around with the drums.
It's a very interesting acoustic structure, West Kennet Long Barrow, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, absolutely. And we went to Avebury, and, of course, they both, Busty, that's him. Busty. Yeah.
Right, her compatriot.
Yeah, yeah. They wrote the book together.
Because Maria Wheatley's father was a famous dowser, wasn't he?
Dennis Wheatley, yes. He was...
That was Dennis Wheatley the dowser, not Dennis Wheatley from To the Devil a Daughter. Different Dennis
That's right.
Wheatleys.
The dowser, yeah, exactly. So she was quite good. Everywhere she was speaking, people would sticking their ears in and having a little listen, you know, because she spoke with such authority and she had her book there and she had so much insight. That was great. I learned so much today. I just can't begin to tell all the beautiful things that I learned today via Maria.
Yeah.
And we exchanged a lot of information and it was a beautiful exchange.
I think that's another important part of the, to borrow your words, the syncretism that's happening is the meeting of individuals. I'm certainly finding it in my own life, but seeing other individuals meet each other at exactly the right time, and enormous amounts of information are being passed from the right head to another right head.
Well, here I was yesterday, last night, I was in Glastonbury and I presented the Glastonbury Zodiac of the Somerset region there, and... and who should be in the audience but the guy who wrote the article that I'm reading from in my PowerPoint presentation. He's Anthony Thorley's friend, and I was on the part in the presentation dealing with Anthony Thorley's great work. And I went through the journey of the Zodiac that John was there. Right. And he put his hand up and he corrected me on something. And he said, well, I'm the guy who wrote the article. And I said, well, come up to the front and show your face and introduce yourself and tell people where they can get this beautiful information. Because I presented Aries, Taurus and Pisces and I couldn't find information on the other signs. And what I found about Aries, Taurus and Pisces, I spoke about an hour last night. And it was just wonderful because... And then David turned up and he'd written a book. I forget his surname, but he'd written a book about the Glastonbury Zodiac. He signed it and presented me a copy. So synchronicities...
Look at that before we part. I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Synchronicity, that's the word.
Mm. So the eighth presentation I did was on Glastonbury Zodiac. The first one was on the science behind the science. Then in Birmingham we did the nursery rhymes, all the nursery rhymes and how they teach syncretism. So that will be on YouTube soon.
Brilliant. I'm really looking forward to that one.
Then and we did one in Leicester, which was astrotheology. And in Manchester, we did the Philosopher's Stone. In Birmingham, the second presentation I did there, we did the art of gospel writing. So after 5 hours, everyone in the audience knew how to write a gospel.
What are some of the key points that you raised in there?
Yeah, well, the key point would be to understand that gospel derives from the Greek word tragoudia, tragos oudia. Tragos is goat, oudia is ode, song, spell, gospel, goat's spell.
Really?
So, tragos oudia, and today when you go to Greece, you turn on the radio and listen to a song, you're listening to a tragoudi, all right? So, and which goat would that be? Capricorn. Because Capricorn is the starting point of the Philosopher's Stone. Saturn, lead, that's where you begin your journey around the wheel, finish in Sagittarius, where Jupiter is waiting for you. Jupiter is St. Peter at the pearly gates. So you start with your lead, and you go to the 11th sign, Leo, gold, and you turn your lead into gold. And then from Leo, you pass on to the last fire sign, the mutable fire sign, Jupiter with his arrow, and he shoots you off through the gate of the gods on the ecliptic at the Tropic of Capricorn, ruled by Saturn, and we leave from the rings of Saturn.
Mm.
And so we did that, and the ingredients are, these are the ingredients to build a gospel: astrology, astrotheology, theology, alchemy, biochemistry, theology, and just basic, theology is the basic stuff, really, because in that you get your morals, ethics, and things like that, and all the nice things that you live by, but it's the bottom rung.
Yeah.
You know, and all the others are, once you, and sacred geometry, sorry, that's the other one. And once you mix these all in the right order, you have a gospel.
Where does the biochemistry come into it then? Ah. All those other facets are recognised.
Right. Well, the Christ in the Greek system is chrism. In your Gray's and Sontay's anatomy, the chrism is the oil which is secreted from the claustrum, right between under the cerebrum, Aries. Right. It's called the Holy Claustrum or the Santa Claus. And that wax gets differentiated in the third ventricle, descends down the spinal column, down to the sacrum, and from there it must ascend. And once that wax, or bread, or oil, or Christ, or chrism, or soma, ascends back to heaven, the third ventricle, we have ascension. All the dormant brain cells are awakened, and that is the Christ in the Bible, in the Gospels, the Christ within, that the Apostle Paul speaks about in Colossians chapter 1.
And it is a genuine kind of biochemical point in time and space that we're all working towards.
It's, yes, it's the ascension that's happening. It is happening by the grace of nature. Since we are in the age of Leo now, because prior to that, last year, the axis was Virgo Pisces, and Virgo is the house of bread, Bethlehem, the solar plexus. We've come out of hell, and we've gone into the heart chakra, Leo, the Christ, yeah. Regulus. We are in line now with Leo, the heart. We're in the heart, and we've ascended. And this oil is ascending in humanity, whether they like it or not. It's natural.
It means that effectively these kind of prophecies that we talk about amongst the shamanic peoples of us entering a fifth world of awakening or enlightenment or various other words that are associated with it is in fact in our religious books too.
Absolutely. There's only one story.
Yeah.
There's only one story there, yeah. And it's the story of light.
Yeah.
God is light. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Buddha says that. Astrology in the East, Vedic astrology is called Jyotish. Jyotish means the science of light. Astrology means the word of God.
And it does go through these explosions as well, doesn't it? Because mentioning people like the Buddha, and we know that there was that kind of axial age, when was it, sort of 500-600 BC, when there was an explosion of this kind of philosophy. And this is presumably the next move along that line.
Absolutely.
And only one story, and it's the story of light. That's brilliant, Santos. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing. Look forward to seeing your first talk. I've had a request from the chat box from somebody who's obviously enjoying that they'd like to hear a recording of that. So I would like to record it anyway, if I could.
All of the presentations I've done thus far and the rest, Brighton's next, then London, then Ireland, then Holland, then Italy. They're all being. I have explicitly asked that they be recorded. Brilliant. Otherwise, I wouldn't travel half all around the world, because I don't want to just speak to, you know, 50 people that turn up, or 20. I want these to be recorded so syncretism can get out there, you know, and so they will be for free on YouTube.
Brilliant.
It will be all too. Free.
Absolutely excellent. Oh, that's great. Yeah. I really look forward to that. Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's been, like I say, a real pleasure to meet you, and I look forward to spending 2 or 3 days in the field with you.
My pleasure,
thank
bro.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk tomorrow.
Yeah, brilliant. I shall put some more tunes on. I'll catch up and talk to you tomorrow. And
cheers, bro.
See All you later best. On. Thank you very much. Well, that was Santos Bonacci having a chat with me there. That was, I really enjoyed that. I think there's going to be a lot more talking along those lines done this weekend, and I look forward to hearing what he's actually got to say in his talk. I'm just trying to line up another tune, because I've really not been paying attention to this at all. I remember Laurie, not too long ago, asked me whether I'd come across in my travels around the festivals any heavier rock bands, and at the time I couldn't remember that I had, but I did in fact, Laurie, run into a couple of guys from an AC/DC tribute band. They call themselves Mother's Ruin. And this is one of their tunes called Look in the Box. There's likely to be 3 or 4 tunes whilst I just get myself some more water, wander off and have a bit of a comfort break and everything. Hopefully the machine will continue working whilst I'm away. If it doesn't, my apologies. But I will be back with you shortly, and we'll probably be having a bit of a light chat with Vicky, the moving spirit, one of the original moving spirits of Truth Juice Birmingham. We are, of course, coming live to you tonight from the beginning of the Truth Goose Gathering, somewhere close to Stonehenge, and you are, as I'm sure you're completely aware, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com. Some tunes for you. We'll be back with a bit more chat shortly. Thanks very much to all of you for being out there. We really appreciate it, guys.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.